our next speaker is Nicole. And Nicole is currently completing her MA in American Cultural Studies at Princeton University Center for American Studies. And she will commence her PhD next year also at Western University in American Music and Culture. Her research interests are focused on 20th century American popular music, with a particular emphasis on race, gender, and class. Specifically, she plans on exploring the platforms 20th century African American performers used to achieve success among both black and white audiences, and the pivotal role these platforms played for African Americans in the entertainment industry. And today she will talk about the Supremes and Coca-Cola 1965, an analysis on its symbolic meaning.
Thank you very much for the introduction, Joanne. Now, before I get started today, I have a short audio clip that I'd like to play for you guys to just set the mood for my presentation today, so enjoy.
And now I present the group that I hope now presents the Supreme.
Okay, so with that said, the focus of my presentation today is on the Supremes and their 1965 Copacabana performance. During the tumultuous times of the Civil Rights Movement, Motown Records founder Berry Gordy vowed to span racial boundaries by producing music that would become the sound of young America. Motown Records achieved widespread crossover success with both black and white audiences in the 1960s, an era as we know it marked by stark racial conflict. The Supremes led the way, capturing the hearts of American society and media audibly with their accessible pop songs and visually with their glamorous attire and elegant dance moves. Although Motown's artists weren't the first African American artists to achieve crossover success, what is unique about the case of the Supremes was the success that they had with both white and black youth audiences in the 1960s. However, my presentation today is focused on why Motown Records founder Berry Gordy was so determined to have the Supremes play at the Copacabana nightclub in New York City. I argue that much of the Supremes' crossover success was attributed to their 1965 Copa performance, which was a landmark moment in their careers and in American popular music. I argue that Gordy wanted the Supremes to perform at the Copa for three main reasons. First, performing there would expand and cement their crossover success to a new demographic, the sophisticated, urban, white, elite adult listener, which would also validate the presence of the Supremes in the adult-oriented world of nightclubs. Furthermore, it marked the Supremes' entry into the high life of New York's cafe society and subsequently into the white-dominated entertainment establishment, which at this time was centered on the Copacabana. So just to give you guys a breakdown of my presentation today, basically, it's divided into four sections. First, I'll start off with a brief historical overview of the founding of Motown Records and the rise of the Supremes. And then it provides a historical overview of nightclubs and what they represented in American society. Following, it discusses the history of the Copacabana, highlighting its performers and frequent clientele, and also analyzes the pivotal role it played in the American entertainment industry. Last, it concludes with an analysis of why Gordy was so determined to have the Supremes make it to the Copa. Berry Gordy founded Motown Records in 1959 in Detroit, Michigan, with the hope of producing the sound of young America. In his two-story home called Hitsville, USA, Gordy launched Motown, which became the only African-American-owned independent recording company in the white-dominated music industry at the time. Evident in Motown's slogan, "The Sound of Young America," Gordy wanted to create music that was universally popular and appealed to people regardless of their race. Simply put, he wanted Motown's music to be valued for its sound, not color. By achieving widespread crossover success amongst both black and white listeners during such a divided area, and again, this is within this youth pop idiom, Motown revolutionized the music industry and transformed popular music in the United States. Now, key to the crossover success of Motown was the highly successful girl group, the Supremes. The Supremes, which included Diana Ross, Florence Ballard, and Mary Wilson, were signed to Motown Records in January 1961. Widespread success for the Supremes did not come early on. For the first 2.5 years, the Supremes had a high number of mediocre singles. At this time, their success had been basically in the R&B charts with the occasional low appearance on the Billboard Top 100 chart. It was not until late 1963 that the Supremes had success with their first pop hit, When the Love Light Starts Shining, through his eyes, which reached number 23 in the Billboard Top 100. With the help of Motown's talented in-house songwriting team, Holland Dozy Holland, by 1965, the Supremes had produced five successive number one hits on the Billboard Top 100, most notably Baby Love, Come See About Me, and Stop in the Name of Love, and made popular music history. Overall, the Supremes achieved 12 number one hits by 1969 and also achieved acclaimed international success, the first Motown group to accomplish both. Now, in order to fully understand and analyze why Berry Gordy was so adamant on having the Supremes perform at the Copa, it is necessary to discuss the history of New York nightclubs and what they represented. The emergence of nightclubs can be traced back to the Prohibition era of the 1920s, where speakeasies rose to prominence selling alcohol illegally. Although at this time they were not considered reputable places to attend, following the demise of the Prohibition era in the mid-1930s, New York nightclubs became regarded as urban fantasies, full of romance, glamour, and excitement, the epitome of New York nightlife. By the 1940s, the number of New York nightclubs had doubled, and the nightclub business transformed to become an industry based on social and entertainment power. Clubs such as the Stork Club, 21, Harlem's Cotton Club, and El Morocco catered specifically to the wealthy and prosperous urbanites of the city and provided their patrons with only the finest and most sophisticated experience New York City nightlife had to offer. Entertainers were also pivotal in attracting people to clubs. The nightclubs able to hire the most popular acts of the day were indubitably the most successful. However, nightclubs also served as a launching pad for establishing the careers of many performers in the entertainment industry, such as Sophie Tucker, Frank Sinatra, Duke Ellington, Jerry Lewis, and Dean Martin. Additionally, celebrities were a landmark feature of nightclubs. They were regular guests, and their appearances elevated the club's status. Nightclubs also, also elevated performers and the rich to celebrity status, further enhancing the glamour and air of exclusivity surrounding nightclubs. Moreover, with the advent of national broadcasting, radios began streaming nightclub music to homes around the country, and gossip columnists for newspapers began appearing at nightclubs and writing reviews about them the next day. Overall, all the aforementioned points contributed to a longing and desire to take part in the elite life of New York nightclubs. Okay, so keeping this in mind, I want to shift the discussion to focus on the role that the Copacabana played in New York society and in the entertainment industry during the mid-20th century. The Copacabana opened up on Wednesday, October 30th, 1940, on Manhattan's Upper East Side, and was founded by publicist mogul Monty Prosser, who played a pivotal role in publicizing nightclubs all over the city. However, the Copa became associated with part owner Jules Podell, who became the face of the club from 1950 onward. The Copa set itself apart from other nightclubs with its commitment to first-rate entertainment. Since the onset, Copa shows were more similar to grand on Broadway ensembles, with full staging, choreography, and costume design departments than typical nightclub shows. Frequent signature acts from comedians Sophie Tucker, Joey Lewis, and Jerry Lester proved to be increasingly successful, along with the sweet singing of Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, and Bobby Darin. These acclaimed stars brought prestige and distinction to the Copa and continually elevated the status of the Copa to that of the most popular night spot, not only in New York City, but also in the United States. In addition, the Copa played a fundamental role in launching the careers of many unknown performers. Performers such as Perry Como, Janis Paige, Edie Fisher, Sid Caesar, Johnny Ray, along with the eponymous Copa girls, all had major career breaks following their Copa performances. Whether a veteran star or an aspiring one was performing, the Copacabana had a tremendous influence on the careers of its performers. As Frank Sinatra famously stated, "You're a show business nobody until you've made it at the Copa and do three shows nightly." Furthermore, part of the prestige and glamour of the Copacabana derived from its clientele. As mentioned earlier, celebrities were a defining feature of nightclubs and contributed to their exclusivity. At the Copa, audience members included famed movie stars, performers, and acclaimed sports figures, thereby heightening the elite nature of the club. There was even a radio program broadcast from the Copa, Meet Me at the Copa by Jack Egan on WHN, which interviewed celebrities in the Copa Lounge, bringing the star-studded life of the Copa to middle-class American homes. Additionally, members of the popular press and music industry were also frequent guests, further heightening this exclusive nature surrounding the Copa. Nightclub columnists such as Ed Sullivan from New York Daily Times, Earl Wilson from New York Post, and Jack Thompson from the New York Journal American played a pivotal role in publicizing Copa performers and impacting the course of their careers. Additionally, from the music industry, reporters for magazines such as Variety and Billboard, along with executives from record companies, most notably Columbia Records, had correspondents present at every show. They too played a pivotal role in publicizing the club as one of the most desirable to attend and perform at, and also in influencing the careers of the Copa performers. Also important in mentioning was the Copacabana's no black policy, which was in place until 1952. Although Lena Hohen was the first African-American to get a job in the Copa Lounge downstairs in 1945, no African-Americans were admitted or booked for the main room. It was well known that both Harry Belafonte and Sammy Davis Jr. were denied entry as guests at the Copa in the early 1950s. However, Sinatra, who was appalled when Davis was denied entry to see one of his shows, was pivotal in overturning this no black policy and was able to convince Padel to let Sammy Davis Jr. return the next night and see his performance, and thus was pivotal again in overturning this policy. Later on that same year, jazz baritone Belly Eckenstein became the first African-American to headline the newly integrated club, paving the way for Sammy Davis Jr. and the Will Mason Trio in 1955 and further performances with Sammy Davis Jr. as 1960s approached, Harry Belafonte in 1955, Ella Fitzgerald in 1957, Nat King Cole in 1958, and Sam Cooke in 1964. However, it is important to highlight that the aforementioned African-American artists who performed at the Copa were foremost adult entertainers, and secondly, were either jazz or soul singers. Therefore, the Copa appealed to Gordy not only as an opportunity to make it at this historically defined and predominantly white venue, but also as an opportunity to be the first African-American youth pop artist to perform there. So overall, although the Copa was not the most profitable nightclub in New York City, it was by far the biggest and most famous nightclub of the time. Entertainers considered it the mecca of the nightclub world, most famously coined the Carnegie Hall of Nightclubs, and performing there signified that one achieved the summit of fame. Even the epitomized Copa bonnet, which was awarded to successful performers, represented the Oscar of After the Dark entertainment. Overall, the Copa proved to be a place inextricably tied to the American entertainment industry, and it is clear that making it to the Copa had a paramount influence on an entertainer's career. Okay, so after analyzing the history of the Copacabana and the evolution of New York nightclubs, we can understand why Gordy was so determined to have the Supremes perform at the Copacabana. As mentioned earlier, Gordy founded Motown to capture the widest spectrum of fans. According to the Boston Globe and Chicago Defender in February 1965, the Supremes' current fan base consisted of black and white teens from the ages of 13 to 16. Gordy saw performing at the Copa, a historically all-white nightclub, as an avenue to appeal to a greater white audience, the sophisticated elite white adult listener. Along with performing Motown hits against an augmented background orchestra, the Supremes also performed traditional American standards, beloved Broadway classics such as Somewhere from West Side Story, Do Re Mi from Rodgers and Hammerstein, and also songs from the acclaimed musical Bye Bye Birdie. Gordy hoped this would further enhance the appeal of the Supremes to the star-studded and predominantly white, well-versed audience of the Copacabana. On a larger scale, by having the Supremes perform such treasured classics, Gordy hoped to validate that African-American pop youth artists could perform adult-oriented material. As mentioned earlier, by performing at the Copa, the Supremes would make popular music history and become not only the first R&B group to perform there, but also the first black youth pop act to play there. This groundbreaking moment would validate the presence of the Supremes in all facets of the American entertainment industry as authentic performers for fans of any age. Additionally, Gordy was so adamant for the Supremes making it to the Copa due to its association as the epitome of high society in the United States. As described throughout this presentation, historically, New York nightlife was associated exclusively with the wealthy and elite. The Copacabana embodied the glamour, sophistication, and exclusivity of New York's cafe society as the turn of the 20th century approached. Thus, aside from a racial motive, Gordy wanted the Supremes to perform at the Copa to become associated with this glamour and glitz of New York's cafe society. Moreover, historically speaking, and obviously we know that that is what the Supremes are associated with, is a form of music associated with low culture. Therefore, by performing at the Copa, the Supremes would not only become names associated with the elite nightclub tastemakers, but also elevate the status of pop music as a reputable form of music in the sophisticated adult-dominated world of New York's cafe society. Gordy knew, as stated in his 1994 autobiography, To Be Loved, that the Copa was the gateway to making it big into the white-dominated entertainment establishment. As described earlier, the Copacabana was indubitably linked to the American entertainment industry, as the club had tremendous clout in catapulting and cementing the careers of its performers. With an audience filled with prominent newspaper columnists and executives from the music and entertainment industries, successfully performing at the Copa would lead the Supremes to achieve widespread fame in the white-dominated entertainment establishment. Thus, Gordy hoped that the Copa performance would lead to further performances at other high-caliber venues, including other nightclubs, television variety shows, and other revered places such as Lincoln Center and Carnegie Hall. It was Gordy's intention to have the Supremes be regarded on the same level as other classic performers, such as Ella Fitzgerald, Judy Garland, Frank Sinatra, and Sammy Davis Jr., and he knew performing at the Copacabana was the gateway to such success. On a larger scale, successfully performing at the Copa would not only validate and legitimize the presence of the Supremes in the white adult-oriented entertainment establishment, but also pave the way for African-American youth performers as a whole. So overall, to just conclude this, making it to the Copacabana proved to be a landmark moment not only for the Supremes and Berry Gordy, but also in American popular music and culture. Thank you.
Just a quick underline of the, because you mentioned Nat King Cole there, the associating the Copa and the importance of breaking into the white-controlled industry. In the early 50s, I can remember this, Nat King Cole got a shot at having his own TV program. I think it was CBS, I'm not sure.
It was 57, NBC.
NBC.
It was the same
show. And in those days, it was possible for NBC to basically sponsor him without having any other sponsors. After 1 year, they had to drop him because they could not find a single person going to sponsor a black person on TV.
Okay, yeah, I mean, yeah, Nat King Cole made, so that was 1957 that he had the TV show, and then in 1958 he made it at the Copa. So it's interesting that you raised that, because I wonder if that kind of exposure and that platform via television, you know, could have helped him, because I think he was the third African American performer to play at the Copa. But I'm wondering if that exposure could have, you know, definitely contributed to him making it to the Copa and becoming one of the first African Americans. And obviously, this is a groundbreaking moment in history to play at the Copacabana. So I think, yeah, that's definitely interesting and a point worth absolutely looking into. So, yeah. Thank you. Oh, thank you.
I'd love to hear you talk more about that. I wonder if you have thoughts about why the Supremes, right? It seemed like the images you showed about the performers through the industry could look like there's a preference for male artists.
Yeah.
A lot of male stuff. And I wonder, you know, why, I have my own thoughts about this, but I wonder what your thoughts are about why Berry Gordy was so set on the Supremes and not, you know, the Temptations.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's a really good point. And actually, what I presented today is the basis for my thesis that I'm currently starting to delve into. But that was also part of my thesis project, but I've had to cut it out due to kind of narrow focus. But yeah, I've definitely spent a lot of time thinking and pondering the point that you raised. Anyways, obviously, I mean, there were emotional kind of issues going on between Berry Gordy and Diana Ross at the time. But I mean, I'd like to speculate and say, in terms of the civil rights movement, obviously going on simultaneously during this time, the politicized, you know, there was a very politicized image of the teenage African-American girl. And obviously, you know, kind of referring to the African-American, you know, historical stereotype as uncultured and primitive, not sophisticated. However, I'd go on and speculate that Berry Gordy chose the Supremes in order to kind of contradict this traditional stereotype and show that, you know, African-American performers, but obviously as a microcosm of society, are well-polished, are sophisticated. And that would kind of contradict because, I mean, as we know with, you know, events in, you know, with Rosa Parks in Montgomery, Alabama, and with Elizabeth Eckert in the in Little Rock, Arkansas exactly, the teenage African-American girl was incredibly politicized. So we have kind of two competing images, right, being seen in news media in the 1950s and 1960s. So that was kind of the direction that I was leaning in, and hopefully I'd like to pursue that further in another project, but yeah.
That's very apt. I have come across it already. I recommend Gina Brown's work on that one.
Okay, great.
Okay,
great, thank you.
Well, it's really a follow-up, so I wouldn't object if there was another question. Were they dating yet in 65?
I think
that,
yeah, no, I know they're romantically involved. So, I mean, yeah, I guess we could, you know, go on and say that, but.
Sort of, I think. They were certainly on the
verge. Yeah, I wouldn't know if I'd say they were dating, but.
There's chances, yeah.
Yeah.
Indeed,
yeah.
Indeed.
I'm not sure.
You kind of alluded to it. I'm just wondering if there was, if from Barry Gordy's side, you're kind of arguing, well, he wants to kind of get into this more adult, serious market. But if we go to the Savannah side, 1965, the baby boomers are starting to come of drinking age and going out age. This is the same wealth and youth. Who is your next market? If I'm thinking marketing, I'm thinking how many of us are getting these young people to read? I mean, was there anything from that side that was like, hey, what was saying we need to start thinking of a more youthful audience here?
I haven't come across anything in particular. What I've seen, okay, so the Supremes appeared on Ed Sullivan in December 1964, and then their run at the COBA, I don't know if you can see, so it's from July 29th to August 18th, and you raise a really good point with the baby boomer audience coming, you know, coming of age. And so during this time...
9 and 21 in the States.
But was it then? I don't know.
Yeah, it went to 18 and 71.
Okay.
Anyways, during this time, basically it was the off period at the Copacabana. And so they used this kind of summer period with a lot of their regular patrons were away as kind of a test period for new up-and-coming acts. So basically that's what I've seen. I've come across in a lot of autobiographies, which has kind of been my behind the door kind of access into, you know, what was it really like going on behind the scenes of the COPA. So anyways, Jules Podell gave the Supremes a chance anyways during this off period as kind of a test run to see if they would be successful in the COPA's prime time, which was the season started up in October and ran to March. So it was basically like a test run. So that could kind of, you can kind of speculate and say, you know, this was an opportunity to see if the Supremes were a viable act. To play at the Copacabana, which was a historically all adult-dominated nightclub, but...
Thank you.